My name's Demo Wise. Welcome to the director commentary of Only God Forgives. I'm here with the writer-director, Nicholas Winding Refn. Hi, Nicholas.
Hello, Damon.
Well, we're going to be talking about the themes and the ideas and the locations and the characters in your new movie. How would you describe people coming to this movie directly after Drive?
I usually use music descriptions, but probably the best way to describe this was that Drive was going to feel like really, really good cocaine, and Only God Forgives would then be very, very strong acid.
Now, it starts very ominously.
Well, you know, that's my name in Thai. Mm-hmm. The whole basis for that was to completely erase any kind of westernized sensibilities in the beginning of the film.
And here we have the blade, which is a recurring motif throughout the film.
It certainly is part of the structure. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that I heard this very interesting story that some years ago, the last Thai executioner quit his job because he felt the way that they were executing people was no longer humane. He wanted to do it by the gun. Mm-hmm. And that was what was working, he felt. But now that they have stopped that, he quit his job. Mm-hmm. So the idea that this character's mythological figure has this weapon behind in secrecy, that's part of his power, is that he has this sense.
There's a lot of physical brutality in this film, in particular boxing. Why did you've always the film kind of changed over the years as you were developing it, but the Thai boxing element was always there. What interested you about Thai boxing or boxing in general?
Nothing really. I'm not a big. I don't know anything about boxing. I mean, it's fascinating, but I don't watch it. And I knew very little about Muay Thai. But when the whole film came about, right after Valor Rising, I went to France and met Wild Bunch of Gaumont, and I knew that an average French film would easily cost €6 million. So I said to them, I'll give you two movies for six. And they were like, okay, great. We'll pay for 2/3, you pay for 1/3. And I went, okay. Then I'll write, produce, and direct. They went, okay. And the deal was done. And in order to finalize the paperwork, I needed to come up with a story, so I know what they were getting into. And so I came up with this fight story, basically just, you know, taking a traditional fight movie by saying it's going to be about two people in Bangkok who's going to fight it out in a Muay Thai boxing match. So that's how it really all began. And, you know, then you kind of go on from there.
Now, is this all one location? Because we see this is kind of a very specific environment within the movie. We see this is where Ryan's character spends a lot of his time. Well, here we are in that room. Is this all part of the same?
Yeah, I mean, because I shoot films in chronological order, I have to be very specific in terms of location and how I use them and how I can move through the locations. But this place was one big, you know, Muay Thai boxing club in the outskirts of Bangkok, where we could had all these rooms that we could just shoot in all the various scenes. So this is where this would take place, but also later on where Ryan's kind of mindset, where he lives, is also there. Everything was kind of shot in that arena.
He kind of looks like a brothel or something, some kind of 70s brothel. I mean, what kind of space is this? I mean, why would they build a building like this?
It's Thai architecture. I mean, it has this very strange ornaments of design. Like that golden statue we just saw was just there. It was a prop that was just around for their fight, when they have boxing matches. It was such a great golden figure that I was like, let's use it, you know. So, you know, the strangest things inspire you. Mm-hmm. This is in Chinatown, actually.
Now, we've just heard Tom say, time to visit the devil. What is it in that line that appealed to you? Why? What's going on there?
Well, the whole idea of Time to Meet the Devil was
a young girl.
That the film begins with would begin with a Muay Thai match and a kind of what you would say a drug deal. So it kind of eases into what you would say conventions. And then very quickly, the one brother would say to the other brother, "Time to meet the devil." And now, of course, that's ominous. What that actually means, is it the brother's time to meet the devil, or is it Ryan's time to meet the devil, or, you know, if there's a god, then there must be a devil.
Mm-hmm.
This was in Tom Burke, you know, is an actually wonderful actor, and you know, this character was really underwritten, I have to say, you know, so we really had to create him. I just had the concept of a brother, but to design him, it was a lot of that was with Tom Burke as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I write, sometimes I don't really put a lot of descriptions in. I more try to find the right actor, mm-hmm. and once you have the right actor, it's more like, what would you like to do with this character? How can we make him? How can we breathe life into him?
So, what did Tom discuss with you in this instance?
Well, it's very much about, you know, the idea of a sexual torment. You know, because I had this idea that the mother was like an insect, that she would feed on her own. She was like primal in that sense. And so we were talking about, you know, the sexual behavior of the mother, which is something I talked to Ryan a lot about also, and how that seeps through everything. So the brother is clearly seeking something.
And here we have hands, which when you see the movie the second time around, you begin to notice that we have the motif of the hands. Here we have the boxer, Ryan, kind of looking as if the hands don't belong to him.
True.
And did you find that in the editing? I mean, was that?
No, I mean, that was the first image. What you just saw there, what this clenched fish was the first idea I had for the film, was the idea that a clenched fist was like an extension of a sexual nature. But if you opened your palm, it was submission. And I thought there was a movie in that motif. And that's really how everything started to come out of.
Now here we have Vitaya, who's kind of the unlikely hero of the movie. I've heard him described as a villain. Does that surprise you?
He's everything. He's a villain, he's the hero, he's God, he's the devil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can even say, if you look at it, by Ryan clenching his fists, it almost gives birth to this character. This, you know, there's a constant cause and effect in the beginning of the film, and the idea that the beginning one part would be a very, you know, almost traditional police drama where, you know, somebody's been murdered and the police bring this character in to investigate, who has some kind of authority in the world of police, and then it goes back to the brothers again, and then that world begins to cross now, that he will then appear in Ryan's sexual distortion, mm-hmm. as a motif that haunts him, and then we come back into reality that he exists, and then the confrontation between them.
Did you discuss the character with Vitaya? Because, you know, I wonder if he brought any kind of Thai folklore or knowledge to the role or to the character.
Yeah, a lot. I mean, you know, especially when you're in these kind of surroundings. This was shot in a real brothel in Chinatown. That was quite extreme in a sense that they had these rooms, as we had in here, but they had these fence on the door. They had these barbed wire fences, and it was just such a horrifying image, in a way, that they had these doors that were like fences. But once you're in these kind of places and you have a lot of time, you do talk about other things than locations, and the idea that he would be playing, you know, God from the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, you know, when God says, "You have to fear me because I will be cruel, you have to love me because I will be kind." And, you know, coming from the West, we were very much built in this world of logic. And in the East, you know, in Thailand and places like Asia, the idea of logic or reality, you know, coexisting with a supernatural almost religious world is completely accepted. There's no difference between which part you travel between.
Now here we have an interesting moment. This is where the father is basically kind of put to the test by the angel. I mean, would you agree with that? That, you know, he's given a moral choice. You know, he says, do what you want. I mean, I think that's a loaded question.
It is, because it goes back to him. Because God in the Old Testament was cause and effect. And he basically, you know, for this, everything has a consequence that dribbles down through your entire existence. And that's how his logic, this police lieutenant, that's how his logic exists, that everything has an effect all the way down. And if it doesn't happen, he's there to do it. Mm-hmm.
Did the owners of the managers of this brothel, were they kind of disturbed by the kind of carnage you brought to their establishment?
I don't think I could bring anything they hadn't seen. But in a way, you know, they were living in the same location. It's a very bizarre sense. Yeah, it's a classic image of submission, kneeling. They were pretty cool about it. They just, you know, you negotiate a price, which we had these people do for us because it's a bit of a jungle out there. And then they take over from there. Then it's just deal's a deal, you know.
Now, the angel is nothing if not fair, I've decided, because here he's, of all the things, we think he's going to kill him, don't we? Mm-hmm. But he kind of takes an eye for an eye. I mean, is that a fair assumption? Character study, that he is scrupulously fair?
Well, yeah, because his fairness is that it's a very part of all religion. It was always the removal of hands. That was a very way of punishment, was to take somebody's hands away from them, because it marked them for the rest of their lives and it completely mutated their existence. And so the idea that he cuts off hands as a remembrance that you have been judged by God.
This is the first time we see the knife?
Yeah. The act of attire who plays him turned out just in a happy accident that he was a grand master of Kendo. So he had all these sword experiences, because the way you handle these swords is extremely difficult. It may look very easy, and I thought it was going to be easy, but in a way it's completely an art form.
Now we're kind of back to the hands motif here. Now
you're now in the world where it's almost like a conjuring image, or what has happened has almost been Ryan's fantasy, or a combination of both.
I kind of see this as his conscience. This is kind of his a purgatory film. This is his private hell.
Yeah, and he's forever caught in it, and he can't move without, you know, he can't leave it. And the sense of castration and impotency and the fear of the sexuality, but so much more the curiosity of the womb. There was a woman who came up to me at Cannes, and she looked at me for a very long time, and she said to me, "I think this movie takes place in the vagina, correct?" And I was like, "Yes, that is probably very, very true." Mm-hmm. Because there is, you know, the sense of the curiosity of, you know, of an incredible place, but also a very enigmatic place. You know, what does take place in the womb, in the sense that it's the closest thing that we have to God on earth.
Now, I'm assuming that most people who are listening to this commentary will have seen the movie, so we know that there is a terrible backstory involving Julian's bare hands. So am I right in thinking this is a kind of, you know... there's a bit of self-disgust in the scene, that his hands aren't good enough to touch this beautiful woman.
He's repulsed by beauty, yeah, and that he feels that, you know, he worships, idolizes, almost objectifies, you know, beauty, because he's distorted from his mother's control. And the idea was that here we have a character who we slowly reveal through the course of the movie what the motif is all about. That was the you know, it was like an installation concept that if you went through all the images, they will make sense at the end. But you have to go through all the images in order for it to make sense. If you don't, it's like you fall off the cliff. It's a very fine line to walk.
Well, we just had a glimpse of Bataille there. I think it's the genius of Larry Smith that this film has such a kind of inky quality that things come out of the shadows, they come out of the darkness. Mm. That's an easier thing to say than do. I mean, how did you find getting that kind of look to the movie?
The idea of purgatory was, of course, of kind of a reference concept, but also that everything had to be very practical in a way, that it's very unextravagant. This was above the fight arena that was downstairs. This was the quarters where the boxers that would come and train here would live. So they had all these tiny rooms, and then we just put up the wallpaper because the sense that, you know, he's like moving his life, his mind is a maze that always leads back to the same room, which is the bedroom, where on one side you have this very beautiful, sensuous, almost idyllic woman. At the same time, it's also where his mother appears. So clearly his sexual distortion, you know, an effect comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
And when he tries to seek out, it's like he gets amputated or castrated. You know, he's in complete control of his own, you know, of his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a Yaya Ying, who plays this character, was a had been a very famous singer that had burned out very young, like in her teens, and kind of wanted to kind of reinvent herself as an actress. And she was absolutely extraordinary because she didn't have almost a single word of dialogue, and yet she had this very haunting and poetic beauty. But of course, the concept is very, you know, man's fear of sexuality. He fantasizes about it, and yet when it comes to a certain point of climax, the amputation comes in. But also it's an act of violence because it's a violent amputation, it's a violent castration. And leads back to the brother's death. So the structure was that we introduce a character that is being warned as time to meet the devil, then appears in his sexual fantasy. But he's also real now. And this, the two planes, the supernatural world and the real world, now coexist. And at one point he will cross over in either of them and meet to confront.
Mm-hmm.
This was in a bar in Chinatown again. We shot a lot of the movie in Chinatown, and the only thing we did was because I had very limited budget, we were able to buy these lamps and hang them up in the ceiling. And we gave this kind of, you know, odd science fiction role of like radiance in a sense.
The lyrics to the song are almost perfect. You couldn't have written them better. I mean, it really captures the kind of the world-weary nature of this character. How did you find it?
Well, the whole karaoke idea came about because I'm not a karaoke fan. You know, I don't do karaoke. I would be horrible at it because I can't sing a tune, and I don't drink alcohol. And it seems to be in the West those two things coexist. You can't have the other without the one. And but in Thailand it was unique because karaoke is really a religion in a sense. It's almost something that people do as sacred, and there are many karaoke clubs all around, and you see some of the clubs are very high end and some of them are very, you know, deconstructed and so forth. But the way it works is that at night, Bangkok changes a lot. It becomes pure Asian. And from the day where it's very much westernized Disneyland. But at night, I would travel around and all different places, and I began to see and notice all these smaller clubs, not these extravagant almost shopping malls of karaoke, you know, rooms. There were these almost dark hidden cafes in all red lights and neon blue, and you had all these odd figures just sitting there all night singing Chinese songs. And it was just such an intoxicating image that I didn't really know what it meant, but it was more like, I have to put this into the film.
Now, here we have the quintessential Kristin Scott Thomas moment. How did you get this actress to become this person?
Well, KST, as Kristin Scott Thomas is called from now on, had no problem turning on the bitch switch. I was casting unknown actresses in the UK, mainly to do because I knew I wouldn't be able to afford any name recognition. I didn't want to go that path because if you can't afford them, it becomes about schedules. And I wanted to shoot the movie at a specific time. But the casting director suggested that, why not we try her? And of course, you know, she's like my mother's favorite actress. You know, my wife is like, KST is like perfect in the sense that she is she's noble, she never ages, and she ages so well and so forth. And so we sent her the script, and she wanted to meet. So I met with her in Paris. And she was, you know, with all the expectations of what I had known her from. And I really, I mean, she was great, but she was also very specific. And I saw that bitch switch, you could really click on and off. And that's what the character also needed. So when she asked me, why did I choose her? I was, well, why would I want to work with her, really? Because she had agreed to the film. And I was like, well, because you did Four Weddings and a Funeral, which a film I very much admire. And she goes, got it. But if I'm going to do this movie, if I'm going to move your movie, I really need to mutate into something else.
I understand she used a photo shoot as Donatella Versace as a kind of frame of reference.
Yeah, I mean, she sent me, because I was like, well, what do you like to look like? And she goes, well, I want to look like, I want to have long blonde hair. And she sent me a photo of herself. And it was like, Donatella Versace, here we come. And what actually happened here in this scene was the only major change I did in the film while we were shooting, besides the normal shooting chronologically order, openness to how the film moves. But originally this scene had a long dialogue where this one-armed man basically informs Ryan's character, Julian, what has happened to him. And that once they hear, the other Thai actors or characters hear that, the idea, the myth of this police lieutenant is like, it's like an urban legend.
But instead you drown it out.
And when I shot it, it was just absolutely horrible. It just did not work. It was terrible because none of it worked. And I couldn't figure out why until I realized, well, the whole point is that I'm trying to explain the exact mystery. I want to keep a secret. So I just eliminated everything. And it became more about the sensibilities and how music would actually be explaining this story. And if he would remain enigmatic rather than logical. Because, you know, I came from the West to Thailand with a lot of logic in the script because that's how we function. And when I was there, I had a very odd experience which made me understand that if I try to explain the exact same thing I don't want to hear, it'll never work out. So I just kept everything in terms of the just acceptance that there's two worlds that coexist.
Well, here's a good example of that. You know, we have the Vitaya's character's home life. Do you give him a name in the movie? I'm not sure.
No, he's unnameable. He's basically the same character that Mads Mikkelsen played in Valhalla Rising and that Ryan played in Drive. You know, that the force of nature that has a mysterious past and is almost lives in a heightened reality, and they're isolated from reality.
Children seem to know what's going on in this movie. That little girl has a kind of firm grasp of things.
Well, it's a classic case of mythology. Innocence is understands everything, and that's why children and animals are usually so part of mythology and fairy tales.
And we're back to the hands.
The hands motif. But also the idea that there's two worlds in Ryan's mind. There is his psychological world, which is here, and then there's his real world, where he's outside.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically coexist as equally as anything in terms of logic, but we never make aware where we are and what is real and what is not. It mm-hmm. just flows. And of course the motif of the hands and the because now the hands are open, there's a submission and of course a fear, knowing that what's behind, what's hidden in the darkness and what's hidden in the mystery, you know, amputated him the last time. So the fear of touch, of venturing out into this void. It's almost like he's in a womb. He's caught in the womb of his mother.
You've used this kind of motif before, though, in Fear X. There were, I seem to remember, corridors, the color red, the idea of the human mind being quite confining.
Yes. The only problem, it never worked there. But I like cinema that of fantasy and Pandora's box is the best way for me to describe cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as he ventures back into the center of his mind, his mother's there, and of course, she very quickly becomes a sexual object for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even how she touches him and caresses him, and then at the same time, when he tries to morally stand up against her by justifying him, you know, justifying to his brother's death, the mother just completely ignores it as if just completely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But even the way she touches him there, there's a very strong sexual undertone.
Did you choreograph that, or did they?
That was actually KST who just reacted to that, and I was like, this is working fine, I don't need to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we talked a lot about the incestuous sensibilities and how she could use her whole aura around him as oozing of sex.
And she kind of just, a bit like the angel, she kind of just appears. In pretty much every scene, she just seems to just appear. There's no kind of, it's interesting, there's not really a kind of sense of travel or backstory. She just is there.
Well, yeah, but she's almost like, see, a lot of the elements in the movie are describing the various states of mind that Ryan characters, Julian, is caught in. The sense of purgatory.
I'm sure he had his.
And the idea that the scene is when he basically confronts his mother in two different ways, and we never see that. It's never on camera, it's always off. And it describes his weakness. Is so strong that, you know, nothing, he can stand nothing of his mother's power, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know, it's
the idea that she almost comes out of the floor. She's like a conjured spirit in a way, you know.
There's also an idea of the two brothers, you know, the mother says, I'm sure he had his reasons.
Yeah.
That gets a lot of laughs in public screenings.
Well, it's kind of an extreme thing to say, but it also describes how she defines herself. It's about self-preservation.
Get up and kiss your mom.
You know, and how, you know, his brother but had a good point, which is, you know, absolutely horrifying to think about. Idea of kissing your mother and how she, the remembrance of that. There's a kind of a gentle romantic feel to it. And also we took the same, you know, the music that plays in the scene where he sees this beautiful woman pleasure herself, which is, you know, a sense of sexual satisfaction, took the exact same music and played it on here. So you have, there's a strange romanticism between their relationship.
The music in that sense, I mean, we've gone back to the kind of ominous motif now, but there's almost like a kind of 40s quality to the score at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You come back. So a film like Vertigo perhaps is an obvious example, but just I'm not saying that the film is like that, but just it's a specific use of
music.
Oh
no, I mean, Bernard Herrmann was the temp score for the film. I mean, you know, when we had music that we needed to cut to, we used Bernard Herrmann's Day the Earth Stood Still.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Because that whole like dreamlike sensibility and kind
that's
of
business.
But also unearthly. And it's a quite a specific, unique score, and it's first score with electronic instruments. And when Cliff heard that, he freaked out because it turned out to be Data still was his favorite score mm-hmm. of all time. So we were very quickly in the same wavelength. But now it was time for him to interpret it, whatever we were trying to say, his own way.
Billy was killed.
Now, Larry Smith's cinematography, I mean, it's a huge feature of the movie. How much of this is actually there, and how much of this is his handiwork? I mean, the way the way he brings out the colours and the richness of the
Well, the colouring is it's very you now because of the digital revolution, everything is done in the DI, and you can really find that. Actually, it was very much inspired by old Disney movies,
mm-hmm.
you know. But and then what he's great about is just the practicalities. I mean, we were shooting like this, which was a karaoke bar where we could use nothing. I mean, we couldn't bring anything in really. So we really just had to work what was there. And that's where Larry is extremely imaginative and very, very good at what he does, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And fast, because, you know, time was always the issue when you make these kind of films. And this part of the film, this was actually two different scenes that I found more interesting combining. And, you know, it goes to that idea that through the course of any creative process, every process has to have its own ability to add or change or heighten or take away. So from the idea to the script, to the production, to the casting, to the shooting, to the editing, to the post-production, to the, you know, makes everything always had to add new elements, or you could add the ability to add elements. And that's why the and I very much like, and also because the whole movie was conceived like a silent film,
mm-hmm.
that it was all about the images had to tell the story, not the dialogue, because when you live in a heightened reality, the dialogue almost becomes too much logic, and you have it kind of takes away the fine balance.
Well, I think this is what you're getting at. We're intercutting with the mother, who we're about to find out is actually somewhere else, and what she's looking at is the when we first see it, the inference is that she's, or we infer that she is looking at Ryan, but
now
it seems she's looking at these chaps.
Well, she is, you know, like a sexual predator. But essentially, that's what Ryan's character is to her, an object, you know.
Where did you find those guys?
Well, that was actually shot in a gay club that catered to Western men and Japanese women.
Oh, and here we have...
Well, here's a classic example of, you know, sexual frustration leads to violence, you know. The gentleman that he just pushes down is was the stunt coordinator.
Mm-hmm. It looks like he took that full force on his face just then.
He did. And actually in one of these takes, because the other gentleman that Ryan drags along the hallway had false teeth. At one take, Ryan grabbed him in a, I guess, different kind of way, so the teeth fell out of his mouth. That's, you know, ironic in a way.
And again, we don't really quite hear what's being said here. It's a bit of dialogue. I wouldn't say it's drowned out necessarily, but we're not hearing about what's been happening.
It's more about his own paranoia.
Hey, Julie.
That's like that guy Gordon Brown who we just saw. You know, the red headed.
Yeah.
I've used him 3 times now. He's probably a guy that I would continue to use for the rest of my life. He's a absolutely wonderful Scottish actor.
Here we have a moment. It's a little bit like Jaws, this kind of moment. There's the the shark-like instincts of Vitaya's character, and he's trying to sense what's happening here.
Yeah, I mean, the whole I sense that now he knows that something is happening and something is about to come down.
Yesterday.
That, his mother has been up to possibly no good.
Uh-huh.
And all those images that we see on the walls were there at the boxing club. They were, because it's been around for a long time. And of course, that's when
they know
that whoever it is has, authority.
And this is the scene I'm talking about. It's kind of like, in the shark movie, in the monster movie, when the monster passes by.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because at this point, Julian hasn't really done anything, in the world of this story. I mean, he's still kind of, what's the word? The impact of his actions has kind of yet to play out.
Yeah. And now, but it's almost now this, what haunts him in his fantasy world or his subconscious has now stepped out,
mm-hmm.
and meets him in reality. And now that's when he starts to, seek it out.
Yeah.
And wants to challenge it. It's almost like he wants to challenge what has either been conjured up or suddenly appeared. Again, going back to what the brother says, time to meet the devil.
Mm-hmm.
He now almost, wants to confront it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the idea of the film, is that once you leave your subconscious and in a world of reality, you can then fight it out, as mm-hmm. he says. You want to fight.
Sorry to refer to vertigo again, but we have a kind of, I forget what the phrase is, the word is scopophilia. This is very much a scene about looking and thinking.
Well, I mean, Vertigo is a very good film. So.
But I'm thinking of the scene where James Stewart is following Kim Novak for the first time.
This was it. It was very almost impossible to shoot this, because there's so many people in on the streets of Bangkok that, for people not to look into the camera.
Yeah.
Because we shot with no permit, because we needed to be really fast and quick, and it was going to cost too much money to shut the parts down. So we just shot without permits, just went out and shot the streets. And it was like literally impossible to deal with anyone or anything, because people would just be looking into the camera. So it was like, no, look away, look away.
Now, so, this is the first time you really hear what Cliff Martinez did with the music score.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain why, particularly at this moment, why did you kind of withhold that? Sort of
well, the idea that now everything leads to the beginning of a confrontation. Now all the cards have been laid out. All the characters are defined. They all know of each other's existence.
Mm-hmm.
Very soon we won't even know about the mother's existence, and then it will lead to that confrontation. So on one part the movie has a very classical structure, and then on other parts it's about deconstructing that classical structure.
In that scene particularly, you've kind of got the juxtaposition you were talking about earlier. You've got this sort of tower block in the background, and then there's this kind of almost rustic scene. I mean,
ideal surroundings. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How much do you want?
That guy was the only actor could afford to bring in besides Ryan and KST was Gordon Brown. So most of the other casting was done in Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
And he was this guy was quite interesting. He came into an open casting call, had never really acted before, but he had a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
for the camera. Okay. So it's like, hey man, you want to be in the movie? And that's what's interesting about Bangkok, that it has this kind of odd sense of, you know, there are many aliens around, you mm-hmm. know, people that have come to Bangkok for the various odd reasons, and some of them can't leave Bangkok, some of them don't want to, you know, they're kind of like, but they're always alien to mm-hmm. the essential culture of Thailand because they're not Thais. This was a, they have a lot of these kind of odd champagne bars, which is essentially brothels,
mm-hmm.
or high-end sex clubs, but they're visually very, very interesting.
I'd like you to meet
and this one had just like all these flowers on the wall. So, you know, we was really figuring out how we can use locations as our strengths, meaning that there was not a lot of money to change anything or add anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, and art is very much about turning your weaknesses into your strength, you know.
Now, he's meant to give her a dress, a very particular dress. Is there anything we should read into that?
I'm sure there are many people that read into that. But the whole idea that he kind of makes her up, he kind mm-hmm. of, like a doll, he designs her to go and meet his mother.
When you know this?
And then we play, of course, the same romantic theme that introduces them, but also the same theme that, you know, was there when he couldn't, you know, when he was with his mother.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that he's caught between, he's essentially purgatory, caught between women. This was at a restaurant, actually, in Bangkok. One of the things that is hard, that was really tough, was the weather was so difficult. Because of the heat. So once we were inside, it was just like such a relief of just being air conditioned.
And I take it that restaurant is that restaurant.
There was nothing in that restaurant that was not in that restaurant. I think we changed the light bulbs, but that was about it.
An entertainer.
I think this is the kind of keynote scene of the movie in some ways, where the various issues are literally brought to the table.
Well, it's every man's nightmare, you know, when he brings home his the woman he's about to marry and to meet the mother. You know, I didn't know a lot of horrible curse words, you know, or profanity when it comes to women in America. So I asked Ryan what he would suggest, and he came up with the idea of that of cum dumpster, which was a bit like, what does that mean? And then he had to explain it. It was like, oh, okay. So it was in that way, you know, it was very that was a pretty fun time.
Did she get it straight away, or did it take
no a that took a lot of takes. Well, because I had a lot to do with her English going into American.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we heard the word cum dumpster about 500,000 times in one day because she had to train it.
I'm sorry for that.
That is her only... there's this line and then this line at the end when she says, why do you treat her like that? That was the only, you know, thing that... So it was very, you know, you had to find somebody that could convey a lot of emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And Yaya Ying had that ability.
You know the way boys are, May.
We shut this all night. We just, you know.
Billy being the older brother and having a bigger cock.
Sometimes it was challenging in terms because we have very low light levels, so we had to really be careful with the focus.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I mean, I haven't shot film for like, God.
How can you compete with that?
Last three movies were shot digital. And I very much like the digital cameras and the digital look and what they can do.
Ryan's very wide-eyed in much of this movie. Was that a conscious thing on his or your part? The fact that he's holding his gaze, he doesn't look away, and yet, and particularly with the women, you have this thing with the eyelashes is of, but they're about to become more pronounced. But there's a lot of the eye makeup and, you know, the use of, but the focusing on eyes, was that something that you thought about, or is that just a byproduct of?
So I think it's a byproduct, yeah. But I guess the act of not seeing, but also the sheer just concentration you get, the emotions you convey, mm-hmm. from that, the stare, the silence, all those things, makes you, heightens all other emotions in you that usually are subdued because of logic or, noise. Mm-hmm. But once silence comes in, it can be very uncomfortable, but it can also be very liberating. But certainly, it's a very odd world to exist in because we're so not used to silence.
Yeah.
And of course, the idea of the whole movie takes place in tunnels and corridors, and everything is always has a past and a front. Mm-hmm. There's never a close, and it's never closed off.
Yeah. 'Cause she's mine. Now, this is quite an explosive moment.
Well, I mean, she confronts his mother. How, uh-huh. how dare she?
Have you found that you're right about the silence. It does seem to be something that people have found challenging in this film.
Well, silence has been like the challenge of the last three movies. I mean, both Valhalla Rising, Drive, and this. Silence is like a language of silence. Mm-hmm. And it can be very provocative in a sense that it's not seldomly how we view entertainment. Because information has always been very important to convey or consume that as quick as possible for us to understand and move on. Mm-hmm. But once you take away, dialogue, and sound becomes more of a mental, odyssey, we as viewers are forced to look upon in detail, but also in a way become part of the story. And that can be very, some people may hate that, some people may love it. It's very individual.
Yeah.
And there's no right or wrong in it. It's not like that's the good thing to do, that's not the good thing to do, or so forth. It's just you have to go with it. And if you don't go with it, then you're going to spend your whole time fighting. And if you spend all the time fighting it, it's going to be a terrible experience.
Well, here we have the return of the score. What did you give Cliff any kind of direction or motivation on this particular? Because it's a kind of modern but also classic. What's the word? There's a kind of folk music quality to it in a way that the sounds, the instruments being used.
Well, that was like some original, very classic Thai sound, ideas that Cliff had about incorporating a Thai musicality into it. So he used a lot of Asian instruments, but it had to have this kind of beat sensibility, that there was a rhythm in it at the same time.
I can't help thinking this is a kind of Obi-Wan Kenobi moment where he senses a disturbance in the Force, that there is, I think, I've heard people say that they think the angel is someone who knows from the beginning how this is all going to plan out, but I think that he's someone who's very intuitive about the organic nature of the universe, so to speak.
I may be both versions are right. Well, depending on how you look.
two worlds coexisting.
Yeah. This is shot at Chinatown at night, and one of the challenges of shooting in Chinatown was that it's an extremely, it's a very tough area. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not dangerous in that sense. It's just a very tough area. And, hundreds of millions of dollars go through that part of the city every day. I don't know for what or where, but you knew that from the beginning, going mm-hmm. in. What was very expensive for us was paying off the cops.
Yeah.
And having to, because we needed the security and we needed the acceptance that we were there, especially because we would be firing guns at the closing time. And I didn't have the money, basically, to hire all the extra help that was needed. So I was contacted by Hoi Hin Film Festival, which is a festival in the north of Thailand, which is going to have their second year, I think. And they asked if Ryan and I would go and do a red carpet there, like appear at the festival. And, sure, well, we didn't have time. But they go like, we'll pay you like, I think it was like $20,000 or something like that. And I went, well, how about we turn that 20 into 100? And they were like, well, do you promise to show up? We were like, we will show up for sure. And so we agreed on that. And then we came up to Hoi Hin, and they had taken 10% because of taxes, which is kind of ironic because it's all cash.
Yeah.
But all right, and we had to sign a slip. But then we had, you know, $90,000, and I was like, I've never counted $90,000 to see what it feels like. So I said, I want to count it. So I was sitting in a hotel room in Hoi Hin, counting $90,000 to pay off the cops in Chinatown for us to be able to shoot. I mean, not everything had to go to them, of course, but it did help us with like some extra things that we could put into the budget.
Now, what's this building here?
This was a mechanic shop. But what had happened in Bangkok while we were there was they had this whole flooding that had really, you know, shut the city down. So everything was always high up. Everything had been hung up. Like here, everything is hung up in the ceiling because of the water damage.
These aren't reels of film here, are they? Or?
No, they actually weren't. There was something else. They just look like it. But it, just the idea of it seems very frightening in a way. Again, just the illusion is more terrifying than reality.
This character is kind of interesting. He's very mysterious in his own way.
The little boy?
Well, both, actually.
Yeah. Well, the idea was that, in terms of the plot, the lieutenant basically just tracks backwards on who did what, cause and effect. And because of his power, everything leads to a conclusion. And then, you know, there was a father and son who is part of it. And when the father asks him, you know, I'm not afraid to die, or tells him I'm not afraid to die, but please leave my son alone. You can kind of see that the lieutenant always already feels that the father has been, you know, has been punished because the son is handicapped, you know, the child. We found him at a Thai orphanage. He was such a sad little guy. His legs were very dysfunctional. He's been left alone ever since he was born. Really incredible creature. And he, suddenly we were shooting, the boy did this. I don't know if he could really talk either. I think he was also brain damaged a bit. But he did this moving with his hands suddenly up his chest. And it was just so magical. And so in the editing, we decided to, man and I, that would be almost like a like it's almost like there's something higher than even the lieutenant. There's a higher god. And he kind of goes from his orders.
Is it this?
This guy was kind of funny because he was a stunt man, the man who just got pushed, hit. But he's also done a Viagra commercial in Thailand. So there were these ads for Viagra with him all around.
Is this the moment you're talking about?
There you go. Just that the boy did that movement. It was just so unique, you know. Like, and those are the happy accidents of creativity.
Now he doesn't. We have a different punishment for this chap here, don't we?
Well, this time he goes all the way. Like God says, there are different punishment at different things for different reasons. But the idea was judge, jury, executioner, you know.
Yeah. It's almost like a kind of disrespectful kind of, you know, gangster style, you know.
Yeah. Depending on who you are, that's how you turn out, you know. There are the ribs for dinner. This was also shot in one of the gay clubs. There was a specific area in Bangkok that has a lot of gay bars, and they're very colorful, and they're all like this. So again, we were in a location where I just said to Beth, the production designer, don't touch anything. Because we just took some stuff out that didn't fit into the whole Asian sensibility that was already there. But otherwise, like the naked picture of David, all those things were like, this is perfect, you know.
Those ladies, where did you...
That was casting, you know. No, casting.
Your dress designer, your clothing designer must have had a wardrobe person must have had a fantastic time.
Oh, she loved it. She didn't speak a word of English. Uh-huh. I had chosen her because she was the costume designer of a movie that I really, really love called Tears of the Black Tiger.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And she had done all the costumes. But English was not her master, so we had a translator every time. But she was absolutely terrific. I loved working with her. And the crews were great in Thailand, you know. And these, like, because they don't really have an acting tradition, meaning that there's no, like, theater school or actor studio or things like that. A lot of the actors have either been educated abroad or they just started acting. And most of them have, you know, other, you know, jobs, which I guess is common. But they generally have other professions.
The idea of...
Well, this guy, for example, had done a few films and had, you know, I think he had lived in the States a lot and stuff, but his main income he owned a burger restaurant across the American embassy, you know. The guy with all the tattoos in the back was just some guy who had come to Bangkok, could never leave, and just stayed there. But he had, you know, looked very, very photogenic.
It's a very powerful image of the women with their eyes closed. They can't move.
Well, actually, that scene here, in Drive, remember that scene with the hammer and the strip club?
Yeah.
Well, that was what was originally going to happen here. But because in Drive, I needed to make the scene work in a different way, I took the idea that I had here and put it into Drive.
Uh-huh.
Well, the strippers looking at him like it was a theatrical performance, and the idea of the hammer and stuff like that. Being this very violent object. But I didn't want to lose the scene here either because I needed it.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed to come up with something different. And that's why the idea of, you know, when he says, you know, you have to close your eyes and men have to keep them open. It's like the act of seeing and act of hearing is two different things now.
Uh-huh. This is quite... a bravura scene in terms of its use of violence. Did you ever think it might be too much, or did you ever... How did you know what was right for this scene?
It's hard. You know, I just approach filmmaking more. I mean, ever since Bronson, I've just kind of chosen to approach filmmaking as if it's just a fetish. It's like... I make what arouses me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and some things need images of this, and some elements images of other. You know, it differs.
And it's another Old Testament punishment, isn't it? In the sense that he's punished for pretending not to have seen anything or heard anything.
Yeah, and then each piece of his body is taken away. You know, he takes the sight. First he, you know, takes control of his body with the hairpins,
mm-hmm.
and then he takes away his sight, and then he will take his hearing, and so forth. The only thing that I didn't use in this scene was the tongue. He was also going to cut out the tongue, but I think lately there's been too many movies with tongues, and also, I don't know, when I was there I just felt that, you know what, it's more interesting to just take the eyes and the ears, you know. I had done the mute version with Hans Mikkelsen.
Was Vitaya okay with this level of violence? I mean...
Well, it's kind of, you know, when you shoot a movie, it's different because it's all about practicalities.
Yeah.
And most of the time... You would be laughing or going, oh, we got to do it again. The blood didn't spurt right. Oh no, can you stab him a little further out in the right ear so it looks more like you're puncturing it? Things like that, you know.
And here's that moment.
Yeah, it's got to have a halo of light around him. And then of course, this is Chang's world. This is Chang's the beer or the soda water. This is the lieutenant's world, and. Now Ryan enters his hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
Where before he enters Ryan's. And that, of course, leads to the scene right after when he can say the confrontation outside, the classic saloon,
mm-hmm.
Western, you know, you wanna, you know, who draws first wins, you know?
Yeah. Another long look.
A long stare of, you know, he's seeing God. But that was like, the whole idea was that to just focus on these extremely long looks and stares that Ryan had, like he's looking into a futuristic world or an alien world, you know, where it just constantly.
And what's the song here? I understand you originally had a kind of list of more obvious titles.
I like more like American karaoke, because I knew so little of karaoke to begin with, and I saw that those were the famous, you know, people would sing songs they knew. So Marginally Prose was having more westernized, you know, songs, but you know, very, thank God, quickly went away from that, because it made it more silly, and also it took away the religious aspects of it, you know.
Mm. The strangeness.
Yeah. But you know, it's like now the two worlds have coexisted and now they have stepped into each other's hemispheres, so now they outside,
mm-hmm.
a duel can take place.
Uh-huh.
And of course, with any construction of any fight movie, it always leads up to that one fight where our protagonist, you know, wins over the antagonist. You know, that's a classic fight construction. And I had different variations of the fight. I had him. Yeah, I had him lose, then I had him win, and then went back to having him lose again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it was all about the demoralization of who he is, and of course he's also fighting God. How's he going to win? It goes against that. But it also, because again, each scene with his mother is almost a representation of the different states of minds he's in with her, and the idea that as he's vulnerable and completely defeated, she appears to him and in a way manipulates him into doing what he has to do at the end, mm-hmm. by talking about like when he was when she was pregnant with him and how she protected him, how she never stopped loving him even though she was told that something could be wrong, you know. And which is a very delicate situation.
And here we have the big provocation scene of the movie, which is you only have two words. You know, was that ever a longer scene or?
No. By this time we had really combed it down, you know. But also what's clever about Ryan is that he really understands that cinema, when it's silent, has an extreme power. And it's not afraid of that, you know.
Mm.
So, and also once we felt that it became too, when the scenes didn't work with dialogue, we just took them out, and then it was like, then it became more pure because it became about his expression and his, it's like when you take an actor's vocal away, it's like, which is the main way to express, the main device to express, you suddenly use other parts of your body to tell the same story.
Mm-hmm.
But of course it becomes more ambiguous because we're so used to hearing logic that reading things or understanding physical movement or eyes or view, that's why there's so many just static frames of rares of stares from Ryan, because it's almost like the idea that you're, you know, most wooed in to this state of mind that then has different puzzles along the way.
Now, this is not a classic fight scene.
This was the only big set we built, was that dragon head.
Uh-huh.
That was the most expensive production value we had.
Any significance to the dragon head or just a cool design?
No, I just thought it was... I wanted something in the back that had that kind of classic fight motif, especially from an Asian, you know, perspective.
Now, this is kind of an unusual fight scene in the sense that there is a kind of performance aspect to it, that He's fighting God, so to speak, and some every blow. Vitoit's character is trying not to be hit because he doesn't want to fight, but if he is hit, he fights back. So there's a kind of reciprocity that you don't normally get in a fight where two people are trying to beat the other. There's a kind of zen quality to this fight, which must have made it very difficult to choreograph.
Well, also because most fight scenes are about, you know, they usually consist of either stuntmen or stand-ins fighting, or you shoot it in a way so you can hide the illusion of punches and it becomes more about sound. But I wanted here, I wanted to do everything in wide shots. So, you know, almost to the point of they had to have physical impact in their fitting, in the fighting, because otherwise how would they, I mean, how could we do it, you know? And of course, you can't do that because, you know, you do one take and that's it. But the idea that, you know, it's like a battle, you know, like in terms of dance, you see everything is in its full size. Nothing is hidden. I mean, Ryan was green, blue, black, yellow all over his body afterwards, you know. It was aching because he took some massive punches. And also he had to fell. And when he fell onto the cement floor, I mean, that's a massive hit. And he did it again and again and again. And this, of course, it goes back to the symbolization that, like a statue, he is, he's fighting God.
Were there no insurance problems with beating up Ryan?
Well, we did. I don't think we told the insurance what we were doing in that sense. And also, you know, that it had to be a fight scene that had to be over in a couple of minutes, because that's what these are like.
Yeah.
The whole art of Muay Thai is just doing a few right punches rather than a lot of punches, you know.
Am I right in thinking that some of the
That hurts.
The part of the philosophy of this fight is that if you hurt God, you only hurt yourself.
Yes. And there you have him as a statue. Because like God, you know. But the idea was also of not giving the title tenant a name, was that in Valhalla Rising, the Mads Mikkelsen version is, you know, appears, and once he escapes, a child defines him, but how he sees him, how he looks at him, almost like an animal, one eye, because he has only one eye. And then in Drive, the driver doesn't have a name, but he's defined by his action. He's a driver. And except once in a while, Brian Cranston would call him Kid, something like a kindred spirit. But otherwise, he was never meant. He never had a definition in terms of a name. And then in here, the idea for the Vitaya version of the character was that he is unnameable, not allowed to define him. Which of course goes back to you're not allowed to define God. And the idea that here it's almost like the mother is again just appears in his imagination or is conjuring up or so forth and pleads to his inner needs and also what he wishes for, you know, to have his mother.
And again, it's a slightly different colouring here. We've got the yellow as opposed to the kind of
when
sort
I
of
was pregnant with you.
A very intense red and some of the other neon colours.
It was strange, you were different.
It's kind of interesting. I think
and then actually you hear the same music that was in the scene when he fantasizes about penetrating that beautiful woman in the karaoke bar through the beats. And you have, you know, the sense of penetration.
You're right.
Continues all the way through.
I don't understand you.
I think people were expecting more of a kind of showpiece performance from KST, as we're now calling her. Was it, you know, was it your decision to kind of rein her in? Because it's sort of in a lot of movies, the temptation would be to push that character further and further, but you actually go the opposite way, and you, as you say, she becomes this kind of apparition.
I try to do that.
I just wonder how you found the right balance of what her screen presence should be?
Well, I'm a minimalist, so less is more, none is everything. So it's always about less.
And I have no one left to protect.
It's always about, you know.
I know after
you. I believe that.
I'd never ask you again.
Through all art forms, the more.
Take care of this.
The more internal.
Don't let him hurt me.
It actually is. The more external it appears to be.
Get out of here, we can go.
Rather than the other way around.
I can take care of you.
We have a kind of slightly religious aspect to this scene as well, I think, because he's kind of cowed in a sort of light coming down, and she's almost like a kind of Virgin Mary figure, maybe.
Bringing him back, soothing him back, but with manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she says, since your father, I promise you never to do this again. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Or she, you know, the idea that, you know, I'll ask you again to do this, but please, would you protect me? And of course, next scene, we understand that, you know, he killed his father with his bare hands.
Mm-hmm. There are no clues as to what occurred on that fateful day, are there?
Well, it's one of those things where if you explain it, it almost takes away the power of it. But the origin of was it that, you know, the mother was sexually in relationship with both sons, and the father found out.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to remain the kingdom, she had one of the sons kill the father. But it was not her favorite son that did it. Her favorite son was the older brother.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, goes back to the whole scene about the genitals and how she spoke about the genitals as a way to define her attitude towards them.
And now we're back in the angel's house, which is very different to the places we've been seeing.
The idea that it's almost like a little haven in this kind of vast purgatory, you know, that he kind of creates this little world of normality, but also idealism, you know, like old Bangkok.
And kind of humble as well.
And humble and all those things that we that represents, you know, purity and spirituality. And that's what's odd is that it's kind of set, as you said, against the background of a massive, massive city of technology that Bangkok has become. And I remember when we had a very strange experience coming in, because the fundamental reason why I removed all what you would say the explanatory part of the movie was that my youngest daughter, who was 2 years old when we went to Bangkok, has, let's say, abilities, mm-hmm. gifts. And one of the things she can do is that she can see ghosts. And we kind of knew it from when she was born, that the way she would observe things or react to things. We lived in this. This was our apartment in Bangkok when we were shooting, well, our second apartment. Because in our first apartment, when we just first came, my youngest daughter kept on waking up,
mm-hmm.
like 5 times every night. And she would point to a corner of the room and she would scream no. Because she wasn't fully talking yet, so she could only say yes, no, all those kind of basic words.
I was leaving tonight.
And it was just really weird because it was constantly, it was like something was awake, like wakening her and mm-hmm. was trying to communicate with her, because she kept on communicating back very aggressively.
I haven't had any real contact with Julian since he left.
And I called the Thai production manager and I said, listen, there's a ghost in our house. Can you, do you do something about this out here? I remember being so embarrassed having to call. And she was, we'll be right over. And she came over with a shaman who basically walked into the room and, you know, said, yes, there was a spirit here trying to connect with her daughter. It wasn't dangerous, but it was certainly very annoying for her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, trying to understand the situation for us. And that the next day, my wife had to go to the temple and do some ceremony that would help, they say. And the next day, when she came to the temple, the monk asks if he wants a Coca-Cola or a Pepsi. And I just thought that was such a, going back to that world of coexisting.
Yeah.
And that's when I basically took all explanations, all those things that I came prepared with, and said, I'm never going to be able to answer this. And if I did, I would be so, it would take away the pleasure of the mystery. Mm-hmm. And I threw it out the window. Relationship. And of course,
Julian was so jealous.
You know, that met challenges, but he had I like to put myself in situations that are uncomfortable creatively, because that means I have to reinvent myself in it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the mother scene here, you know, where now the mother, in terms of self-preservation, you know, gives up her son.
She's throwing Julian under the train here, isn't she?
So again, it's another shape of who she is.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and this is the least stylized, so I'm assuming this is kind of a fairly representative.
That's who she really is. Yeah, it's like almost this scene, and in the first scene when she checks into the hotel, where she's very powerful and commanding, and now she's very vulnerable and weak, and almost like gentle, and she's like at the same time manipulating her out of the situation, you know, and everything in between is almost Julian's perspective of the womb area of his mother, you know, because the idea that the movie is about a man who's chained to his mother's womb, and in order to free himself, he has to re-enter where he meets God, which represents the womb, where he has to be amputated or castrated or whatever you call it.
This scene is interesting because you have Julian fire several times, and we are left to wonder. Well, not left to wonder, but for a moment we wonder whether he's killed a child.
Yeah. Which I did, you know, consider at one point, but when Matt and I tried it, it like lost. It became more about that act, which is so gruesome.
Yeah.
That you would lose all redemption for him, you know. But it's more like, it became more like a trade-off. He saves the 10th lieutenant's wife. The lieutenant destroys his mother. The one thing that Julian is not able to do.
Yeah.
Which is to kill his mother. That the lieutenant, that task, it's like there's a trade-off between them in a subconscious way, you know.
Okay.
And it was a great pleasure to stab this sword through KST's neck. Because that would, of course, with a trade-off, it would lead to when Julian then takes his sword, you now, again, in a fight movie construction, because he lost the last time, you expect now they're going to, you know, use the weapon of the lieutenant's choice, and then Ryan's character will prevail at the end
as a
winner. A strength we admire. You know, weakness we identify with, strength we admire. So he would, that was a construction of fight moves, that they, you come out as a winner.
Yeah.
And of course, it's not about that. It's the exact opposite. He needs to, it's almost like he knows his mother has been killed. When he comes to her at the end, he with the objective of traveling into her, into the womb where he came from, and that's essentially where he will meet God again, because that's where he can get the real redemption. And this was the second part we moved off to here was...
No ghosts in this one.
No ghosts in this one, but it was also because they had two apartments on the same floor, so Ryan could live next door. So we would live next to each other, which was great because I felt like we were, you know, the honeymooners. You know? Like, you know, like we would always go back and forth between the... Like, kids would run back and forth, and Ryan would come in and eat with us, and... When his family came over, it was like we were on Big Fam. It was kind of like we could do a whole comedy out of this.
Now, you could have put KST in any permutation you wanted. What is it about the way she is positioned in this movie?
Well, it's submission, and of course, it's a sexual innuendo. It's he can penetrate her,
mm-hmm.
which goes back to what a lot of men deal with when it comes to their mothers. He goes, oh, they're like halos around his head. That was just in the ceiling. And that's, again, what was great about Larry was that, you know, because it's due to the situation that I had financially, we just, practicals was basically all we had to deal with. You know? Mm-hmm. And, of course, just by cutting to that shot of his close-up of his crouch goes back to this shot in the karaoke bar where you see his crouch that becomes violent.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's almost romantic as it slides in and he penetrates the womb of the mother gently and slowly.
That must be the most amount of prosthetics that KST has ever worn.
it was a fake stomach. And now it's almost like he goes back into his own mind in the womb. You know? Mm-hmm. Gentle. It was weird. It was a weird day also. Because it was, you know, it was like this is what everything has led to.
Mm-hmm.
Because that it wasn't in the script. You know, it was something that came up along. Because, you know, Ryan and I would talk about a lot what would you like to do with, like, where do you see yourself going towards? Like, what would you like to do to the corpse of your mother? And he said, I want to stick. What if I stick my hand in her? And I thought that's a great idea.
Actually, here you can. It's almost like flames on the wall. There's a mm-hmm. kind of Dante's Inferno quality to that wallpaper.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's burning from the inside. You know. Like furnace, he's like, you know, you can even Chang's out of focus, like he's distorted, you know, just, you know. We called him Chang because it's the name of a Thai soda water. when we were working, because sometimes we just had to defy him or something, because even a call sheet could be like, can you get the unnameable, formerly known as, so we just call him the Chang. This was shot in a park outside Bangkok, and it was the last day of shoot, of course, if you want to, because we had to follow the construction and the idea of now total submission is what it's now about. So, and it's the first time you're actually outside in daylight.
Yeah.
You know, for a long time.
I hadn't thought about the trade-off aspect, so in some ways that explains what's about to happen, that, you know, is there a sense in which he's been forgiven by God, or is he just accepting his punishment?
I guess both. You know, there's a both of forgiveness, but I think it's more the acceptance of the punishment, the understanding that he cannot, it's inevitable and he can never run from it.
Mm-hmm.
Or he will keep on appearing in the image of his mind. And then a karaoke concept, because the film became structured around three karaoke scenes, which was like holding sermon. It was like a priest. He's almost like designed like a priest with a black, you know, black clothing and a white collar. You know, it's like almost gives him like a priesthood arena.
Yeah.
And the last song then would be this very fluffy Thai pop song, which they mass produce in the country, but you know, it seems like he's walking down from the Chinese Wall, steps into frame there.
Yeah, and it's very much a kind of, he's a kind of God's lonely man in some ways, isn't he? Sort of that this is his respite from restoring the world's order.
Yeah, this is his church where he retrieves to. It was incredible how, you know, because it was very important they didn't blink, because if they blinked, they would become human. They had to be complete stoic, And so it was, it took a lot of like, no, okay, don't blink. Oh, they blinked, okay. Fuck, we do it again. Okay, action, don't blink.
Now, we just missed the credit for Alejandro Jodorowsky. If you could just explain for a moment the dedication and how that came to be.
Well, I've become very friendly with Alejandro Jodorowsky in the last 4 years, to the extent that he christened me his spiritual son. And so I go to his house in Paris, and we always have a tarot reading, and usually it's about various things in my life. And it could be anything from career to my marriage, my kids, everything. And it's, you know, that part is very therapeutic. And I felt that I wanted to acknowledge that to him in a larger way. Mm-hmm. So I dedicate the film to him based on that, but also the whole that, you know, the idea that when something works, when something becomes a success, my first instinct is to deconstruct everything afterwards. Like almost that safety net that worked. I'm so afraid of repeating myself or that formula that I have to destroy it. Mm-hmm. So the next film I do is completely deconstructed from that. You know? One could say
that you'd completely deconstructed your working relationship with Ryan Gosling for this movie. You came up with a film that was not what people would not necessarily what people thought you would make after Drive.
No, the exact opposite. You mm-hmm. know, like everything had to be deconstructed around me because of Drive became such a surprise success that the formula could very quickly be repeated. I could get comfortable and just repeat that formula, and you know, that was the one thing that I would not do. And in order to not fall back into it, you had to destroy it mm-hmm. by doing something much different next time. And that's how Only God Forgives kind of became the film it did. It was a film made with the need of combusting, and then the pleasure of creating, because personally the sense of creating works when it's as pure as possible, meaning that the process never repeats itself. Mm-hmm. So it's always like you forget the past when you do it again. You forget the past by doing it again. And sometimes it's hard to forget the past because we all want success. Mm-hmm. I mean, God, we all, that's what we long for. And that's the exact reason why, you know, you destroy it, because it's too easy. Because when you feel, when you get nervous or you feel insecure or you get uncertain about what you're doing, it's easy to fall back into your safety net. Mm-hmm. Do what worked the last time. And that's the chief enemy of creativity, is having, you know, good taste and being safe with it.
It's interesting that you leave us with this amazing piece of music by Cliff Martinez. Why did you choose to end with this? It's almost like we've been withheld the pleasure of this music for a long time.
Well, one of the things that Cliff was very happy with, I think, in this collaboration was that he realized that music would be so much in the foreground, because when there was no dialogue, music and sound suddenly became a major part of the storytelling. So he was like, you know, with Drive, and especially this, he was like, for the first time, I'm not sitting in the parking lot as an artist. Now I'm full frontal lead singer. Mm-hmm. And that was great. He's very good at it. And he understands that the chief enemy of creativity is good taste.
Thank you very much, Nicholas.